This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
With a new title, and let's see, I'm trying to... The Egoist. And the Egoist came from Scott and Stirner's, from Stirner's theories of the anarchistic egoist, and that magazine all the way through the war was a pacifist magazine. But this is what most people don't know about the magazine. In that Egoist, between 1912 and 1914, but I just want to write these like they have Mozart, Bach, and so forth around the top of music halls. These people were all printed. And only these people, by way of talking about cliques. you say, wow, how do they know how to edit it? As a matter of fact, some of these people hated each other so much that Lawrence and Pound just got acute indigestion in one meeting. I mean, it was almost worth it. How in the world were you going to get them to be in the same magazine? What? And that is a wave. I mean, how did that, when I talked about things you do not know about, this you don't know about, how does it happen? And the experience of it is you suddenly find yourself a contemporary, which is, there are whole generations that never found themselves as contemporaries. Patchen never had a contemporary, Rexroth never had a contemporary. That generation, which is a funny in-between thing, Muriel Rukeyser belongs to it. It is shaken somehow here. It's as if you had a very strong image like this. And you had an after image like this. And believe me, it's like that. Rexroth hates every one of his sources here. He has another source up here that he hardly hates, which is Robinson Jeffries, but who is not in this, but who is in the same generation. And Rexroth is a combination of Robinson Jeffries and Ezra Pound with an image here. And he hates both of these sources, so you can tell right away what it is that he draws on. No, but this is the way, no, by negation. Patchen said to me, why do you write good? Well, I wrote it, of course, because I saw the candle. I thought I'd write good that way. Maybe it'll happen. He says, you don't want to write that way. That's like Ezra Pound. But that's what happens then, is that you had another thing happening. And then this is happening in poetry abstract. Like Robinson Jeffers really belongs with this, so he didn't know any of these people at all. But you only have to watch at the productive period. Well, I mean, or say, so he isn't in the Egoist, but what about the role of Greek drama? What about the role of Chinese poetry for all these people, which they discovered? And yet, as a matter of fact, we can add many, many, many contemporary figures that don't give this shape and size, who are all really creatures of the same tide flow. And that tide flow, I don't know, except that it is a tide flow that these people make too. I mean, that their work makes. The tide flow in poetry is something I know now. It's as if at this level, the poem were the mark left when the tide is gone and you can see what has happened in this contour. You can see by the way those anemones are where that tide goes and where it's been short of tide and where people have been able... And another thing. There are anemones that live in the fullness of the body and who get to that root and will have on... And so that the lowest tide will reach them. The lowest, the deepest one. And that's part of what these people have. There are poets crowded in after every one of these periods. There are poets who have been simply crowded up, springing off these naturally, crowded up into an area where the tide flow is not going to reach them, and only somebody who breaks with it in some way is so that there's both a following after and a criticism that has to come to fun. These organisms have to have made room, or something has to have happened. Well, all of them now are actually Marion Moore, who followed a very conventional form, never did. Neither Eliot nor Marion Moore
had a major phase, a late major phase.
Eliot's four quartets is a summation, and after that,
whereas these poets all had major phases as old poets
from their 70s, from their 60s and 70s. In their, beginning in their 60s, coming to its fullness in their 70s, and now only Pound is left. Certainly, I feel if Lawrence had lived, but then that's meaningless, because actually Lawrence is a shape, and it includes his death. These people do know of their deaths, that's why they have their major phase.
And there is some funny kind of if you follow in Eliot's plays, and the proprieties that Eliot and Marion Moore share, they're wanting to have meanings to stand for the roots instead of the disturbance roots are, which are not meanings. That's what the essence of, let's say, having a church or having a... those meanings, of course, the forms of a meaning would derive from the roots at some point. But when you go back to roots, all this gets disturbed and changes. It can change so vitally that a word like vital can cease to mean or can seem to be wrong in one at another place.
I was thinking, for example, I don't want to get involved in terms of criticism. What is criticism? But why the events? I believe the events are different to the response. In other words, if I go, that noise is indifferent to who hears it, except as that becomes also an intersection of an echo, or another sound sounds and hears.
Yeah.
Not through terms of meaning, but through terms of actual event. Equally present. So what I'm trying to say, because we are in a classroom at moments in the classroom, and go in and out of it with my own consciousness of it, why I'm trying to say is that critics at the moment, or at any moment, if they begin to try to deal with these things as though they aren't happening, but rather are some kind of other possibility, they become awfully ugly. Alan Knight, for example, the Edmund, he was telling me of a meeting between himself and the Buzzard people. It can meet anybody. This man actually proposed that art was the creation of critics.
Yeah. I think he's even thought Eisenhower is possibly a latent homosexual. He has a certain obsession, too.
I see a lot of them. People here, recently, myself, in an agony of concentration last night, in terms of I wanted to strip from me every vestige of this association. Literally, I wanted to come out in late night. But on my way, to destroy all this. Destroy it, literally, as any conception that I found relevant to anything in the world that I love or recognize as actual. Simply the beauty of the thing is that we are here, that's all. It's a very simple beauty. In a sense, it can be simply felt. And then can go. But what I'm trying to say is that so many of you have come, this is what I've been, you ought to be rid of this preoccupation. One ought to help you, or help me, equally, to be rid of this preoccupation of the meaning as some basically integrated term and is critical.
Oh, and now I get something. And your business is not to turn the tide on, by the way. Because your business is to live in it. I mean, you've got to get the feel of it, that's all. I mean, rightly, it isn't... Something's happened in poetry when you get what I call a disturbed generation, like the one of Muriel Rukeyser, Patch, and Rex Ross, and so forth. And in a sense, we feel they don't make it. But they don't make it like life doesn't make it. They do. In another sense, they make it. They show you how you can make it when the tide is that way. And the poetry, you can go back to it as a document and find out how people actually came. What was poetic consciousness? See, we're talking about something abstract, not about these names that I put up there. The works of these people give us a picture of something that is really that you're engaged in when you're writing, which is that now maybe I'm coming to the fact that my picture that it's a stranger. And certainly it's a stranger of Pound and Lawrence could just hate each other, because now for me these are... And then you can turn around and certainly most of us stemmed from a combination of Lawrence, who is not usually observed to be one of the sources of our model for how to live.
you know, how to live in this poetry thing and how to find the poetic tide. And then there are many other models for how to find the poetic tide. Actually, it seems if we go back to the critical picture, and the critical picture is the crisis, how do I survive it? Everything screams that. And everything wants to imagine the crisis to come. The critic feels that if he looks at Howells, if that happened, like, people go berserk. And you keep wondering, my goodness, I don't really think you would go to berserk. And to said there's quite a row of critics at the present time who feel civilization would collapse if you wrote a poem like the Pindar poem, which I thought was Civilization or something. And actually, they're just talking about, what they're talking about is, I couldn't possibly survive. If a crisis is ahead, a crisis is ahead. If this happens, I'm way up on a rock here. Help, help. We got to have a little warm water, please. or let's design it so like the tide's even and we don't have it up and down.
Alan was talking at the end also with the sense of, we got into the words of sense of water. And Alan suddenly started laying on me like that. All the titles of those critics' books, like Race to Water, The Rational Imagination, and all these.
Because I was bugged for years, being
said,
you and Bob were using the word order. And I could stand it because all my education with the word order and the associations with the word order have been the most disordered and monstrous.
But we weren't getting them from that source. We were getting order from, and for instance, but then sometimes a thing that you become obsessed with can be puzzling. Like, I really felt guilty about having obedience, and yet I realized something at this level, everything at the meaning, in my most conscious mind, being a devout anarchist, when I came across the fact that the word obedience and law were somehow crucial, and every time I touched him, it was like you would just get the charge back suddenly. Actually, all your being began to flow, and you heard the law. No, but it's actually. I don't know. I mean,
a policeman.
I never come on like for policeman.
Simply, what is this conception of dysfunction? Where, you know, who is it? What is his meaning? What does he mean by that? I mean, what is the meaning that's proposed? In a sense, I find we were talking about ritual. This is how we get the
ritual is the word.
And I was saying the ritual, for example, of winding one's watch or making it consciously or otherwise into a fetish term by attaching a string to anything to give it the right meaning and then to forget it. Trying to think of what signs or what places or what characters or what could be qualified as characters. In other words, how do you act in a temple without any pomposity or sense whatsoever? In other words, how does one Whitman must have had this.
He had, for instance, rituals of the way the poem moves, which are very. That's why Whitman has been a great religious force. It's not just. As I say, we can't divide the area of meanings. What that religion had to say, from the fact that it was very close to religion because of its high ritualistic. Certain poets you can think of as highly ritualistic. And really, you can't read the poem without knowing the very thing the poets entered in order for the poem to happen. I think George Herbert or Whitman would be identical in this respect, because the poem has the first thing you recognize about the poem is that you have moved into the divine. Now, we haven't even included in this picture about trees or the event how the divine world is there. And the thing which is certainly was always there for Whitman, and because this event that I was talking about, at least I want to make clear, is not yet in any sense one in which there are spirits present. This is a big open possibility of what the event's going to be. It's the pure thing you are.
Anyone want to bring up anything that either confuses them as weird, doing the other thing that Alan said to check back to make sure that you're following, or that
Any questions
or anything about that? Yeah.
Well.
I would be curious to know, Alan, both of you were talking about shifts of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Remember? Shifts of consciousness.
Yes.
Last
He was saying, I was saying more or less the same thing. Pardon me?
So I think Robert said that we are
yes. We're all saying the same thing using our different imagery or different words. I think when I speak of eternity, say, or when I speak of feeling, or when I speak of coming back to a familiar place,
that's a root thing.
It is what he sees as, or he expresses as, a stranger, but it isn't either familiar or a stranger. It's beyond words anyway, but expressed through these particular symbols. He uses the word ritual, or Robert uses the word ritual. For when I say big, in other words,
big.
When Kerouac says, I think there was a big familiar railroad conductor on the train. He would use the word. He would make a sentence in which the word ritual was attached to, the railroad conductor winding his watch.
Well, for example, into the forest again, once all roads depend this way and that, but leading back. This is very hopeful, but I didn't recognize what I was saying at the time I was saying it. The meaning to me was completely. If I could convince myself, and along with that, all that is involved with that, that I don't know what I mean, if I could recognize, and I began to recognize in this novel, for example, that I didn't know what I meant. And that not knowing what I meant was nothing to be afraid of. In other words, I came to a reassurance. I mean, the I did. Well, shifts of consciousness simply in senses of. Ritual is the word. I don't honestly know the word well. But what I'm trying to say is, when I speak of shifts of consciousness, when I'm speaking, I suppose it's simply in terms of this tide.
Well, a ritual in language always is at this level, vowel.
Yeah, yeah.
You can even so-called other people who do not feel the thing that the person in a ritual, they say they're making meaningless sounds over and over again, and they say, what does that mean when you say, or a professor then who wants to make it important gets whole books and meanings out. But these are part of this area. There's no reason that area not to be there, but and it is there. Anyway, but I do think that the other hazard, and because you come up through an education system, is that you're all given tests about things that you read, so you're worried about meanings or understanding. And actually, this thing of being with it is much more important. It flows, whereas this is the test should be thrown out, and it's very I think one of the most exhilarating thing is to read someone like Gertrude Stein. At least this is my great exhilaration, where in Due Innocence I read it for years thinking that it didn't mean anything. And then they brought out those records of Four Saints and Three Acts, and I realized that it was perfectly clear what it meant. A little something in me died, like that record of the Noel Coward song goes. But I've always wondered why people. Well, for one thing, I wasn't an English student, so I didn't have tests about this sort of thing. But why people worried about whether they understood it or not? Because the feel of it seemed to be much more important. And when you're writing, I think that now let's get it specifically. When you're writing, certainly, realizing that if you've got any meanings in you, they're going to come out in the language. You don't have to worry about them. You have any conceivable thing in the world to say, and you don't know what it is. I mean, the things you think you have to say, then you're wrenching language around this way. But if you follow the feel, and that's hard enough. Try to find the route that feeling wants to go. What is it? I want to write. How in the world would I do it? Then when that opens up, you are beginning to find your little road in language. Not your language. That does get me as if something were wrong. But as if you were finding the way in which you'd naturally grow in the language. And then the critic usually comes along and complains because you've grown that way. Like any, the horse critic says, but that big horse with the heavy feet can't be right. The horse really should be able to win the Derby. Or why they got their little tiny horses. We really are. It's called the age of criticism, by the people who call things things. It might as well be called the age of criticism, like the age of dinosaurs. The us little poets are like those first rather sloppy mammals. They're running around, and nobody really could figure out that they look very good. And then all of a sudden they sprout 20 million different species, and that's insane.
I'm using my own person, but I began to realize that you could never keep up. You could never, for example, understand your own opinions, and you couldn't possibly keep up with all the meanings.
Of course, I get some glee at keeping up with as much as I do. That what I usually focus on when I'm writing a poem, as part of the exhilaration, is recognizing what possibly I just wrote meant, and then I start inventing with that. I mean, and actually, at this level in writing a poem, I'm usually composing with the poem moving. And this is, for instance, the difference that would be observable between, let's take a long poem by Alan Howell and a long poem by me, the poem written by Pindar. Both are, could be called roughly musical forms, because both have to do with being read aloud. They both are written in four sections, or sections that are close to a familiar symphonic form that you've heard, that musicians, in the 19th century symphony, still is a very dominant feeling of any large form for me. So that Alan's poem Howell does not really look like some of its sources, like Christopher Smart, because it's written in a symphonic form. It does not go on forever. Or the cantos, for instance, which are not symphonic in form. They are a light form. Every day there's the whole logic of the cantos form is the one, Pound has actually written the last canto, which is in a drawer, and when he dies, it will be numbered. It will simply be the last number in this whole, and it's not a serial composition. It is thematic. He can return to themes, and it's musical in that sense. But for instance, we're much simpler in form if you take this which interests. So we've got a similarity between Pindar and Howell. And at the same time, certainly, when I start out on the Pindar, suddenly, I don't really have any announcements in Pindar that have to do with who am I, you know? I mean, as I'm really following this Cupid and Psyche thing and projecting like you'd have a movie with certain people, and you really follow along while you're writing. That's what is exhilarating, because the images are right there. You chase after them as fast as they go. You've got an unfolding story. In the first place, I know the story. Everybody does about Cupid and Psyche, but it's going to turn out in some other way, because every time I'm interfering with it, and I suddenly realize it's not going to be that story, but I keep trying to recognize it as it goes along, recognizing what's there in the poem. Well, this happens. I'm sure this has to happen while you're writing Howell, because the poem wouldn't move if you didn't recognize what's there. But at the same time, there is some difference in the intent. Because he has, Alan has something to say in Howell, and I don't start Pindar poem with something to say. As a matter of fact, I started Pindar poem because I couldn't understand that line as translated. I didn't know what it. I was reading a poem, a translation of
Robert,
a.
Oh,
no, I was right? Feeling. Yeah. Well, in this place, it would be identical. I mean, yeah. You're going along a line of feeling.
I had more to feel than to say. Yeah. Which I was a complaint against it. I wasn't really...
Well, no, but look how similar, for instance, certain attitudes. Certainly, there's a great similarity between when I... As a matter of fact, the Whitman section of the Pindar poem is post-Howell and is a kind of mock Whitman thing that includes an area which the whole general area of... now we're back to political meetings and where do you feel them? Because and when I go back to that poem, the effort, that's where I started talking. It was in trying to write this effort at war, I felt I was bogged down in the middle of the poem and that I didn't have any feelings about Korean War at all. Now this isn't true. In the poem as it finally stands, I read it when I went to New York at the time when the students were having strikes against going underground like moles and hiding, and I was to read at Brooklyn College, and I arrived and everybody had been arrested or thrown off campus or something, and we had the reading off campus so that the audience could be there. Well, this I read this effort of war, but I started out by saying the whole thing. For the poets, I was in accord with them, because the last thing a poet would want to do, if there were going to be an atom bomb explosion, the poet, the last thing he'd want to do would be to crawl into some hole. I mean, the biggest event you could ever be in would be in a Holocaust of some kind. I remember I used to pour through Defoe's Journal of a Plague Year, saying, gee, people are dying like that. Oh, I've got the plague. this part of this tree, which always wants to be in it, look, talk about the event. What kind of secret event is preparing? All we can think of is that it's goody. They're going to blow it all up, and there's going to be blood running in 20 million directions. This has always been there in poetry. I mean, poets have got, like Marlowe, for instance, run just berserk on the subject, and so they run right into it. Where was Lawrence when they were bombing? He's up on a roof watching the bombings to see what in the First World War. Well, sure, they're innocent. We don't even think of that. We keep thinking that's about like people knifing each other. It wouldn't be, wasn't any risk getting up on a roof. We know in the First World War could have been important. But so that sometimes you think you don't have a feeling about a thing, but the poem will get engaged and it'll be there anyway. And yet this, the danger of, let's say, something awful in politics, or the is the same danger as love, as what happens to a poem when you want the little hypocrisy that sneaks in when you want to have had a feeling you didn't, and make the poem say you had it. Now that's the thing that rules that out, is the simple thing of following your feeling and respecting it, if you just don't know what to do, and then stopping there. That's why a notebook is really finally the best place of all to write when you're writing poems, because then you can let them stop, and then you can always permit yourself to flounder in the sand. Recently I had a poem I did a job of rescuing a poem like this by taking out of a whole series of just boggy old sand poems the things that I saw as being clear and right, and I put them together into a sequence like you would composing with certain sections of music. Especially Webern was very suggestive of the possibility that you could just take discrete bits and see their quality and then use them in a sequence. Get a feeling the difference between these elements.
Also, when I'm not being distinct about myself in the sense of meaning as program, I was doing, again, when you arrived yesterday, when we went to get Charles yesterday, I remember this reference to John Ratchett's City of Night, in the sense of everything is all right if I can just not fall in love. In other words, I can just continue to program my meaning is. In other words, the tragedy, well, like I say, the tragedy of that book lies therein.
It's a form of how can I possibly exist to escape certain experiences.
Yeah.
And that's in a way what you do when you're a hypocrite, by the way, is that you want to escape a feeling that you know you have, and so you design it isn't that a person writes a bad poem or even a dishonest one that's important, it's that they write the poem in order not to feel what they're afraid they would have said if they had followed the feeling. And sometimes that when I wrote the medieval scenes, I was very disturbed to find out that I had such a powerful feeling against life. You know, like Rexroth was saying, poets are really feeling for life. And I found out here that, I got very intense about no babies, no life, no nothing, and separate spirit from body, I still find it rather disturbing, and if I had my hand on the Bible and give my honest citizens, I'd say, why, no, the body and the spirit are one, and happy union. But, you see, a poem might, all of a sudden, something else turns out. It doesn't turn out to be that. And so often you get things happening in poems that really you'll feel, that isn't really me. And it may be, as a matter of fact, why, unlike Alan, because I'm not at home with things that happen in my poems. I make much more use of the mask. I make use of imitating poets all the time, and of proposing poems themselves as masks of poems, because then I don't have to worry about, am I at home with the feeling that's going to happen here? No, it belongs to the poem, I say. It's not me, not really good old me.
When it manages to be there, let's say, it comes through with heavily despite. I mean, it completely wipes that away. In other words, it takes me by myself. And I want to not confuse you further, but what would you like anyone want to do by bringing anything in and ask you questions?
Is it in or
just
out?
Went out.
Just went out.
Bring it back in.
I guess the tide's over here, and you chickies ain't in the top. Is it?
Does the tide, is the tide an undifferentiated character, or any one tide?
God!
And the people who draw them, the best form, the character,
so you mean it's character's shape. I think what I was trying to say, Warren, was that we don't know its shape, and when we assume we do, then we're caught up in what we see. Well, that was, I had an instinct of wanting to write, I worshipped all those names in the first list, and I wanted to write them down. They're heroes. But let's say that only we, even now, don't know that much about their characteristics. And they appear, when you put them together, you see something that you don't if you take one of them. And that's something we're looking at is so real that our not knowing about it. That's like that's what Bob meant there when he said the event is not concerned with the response. The fact that we respond is our organic being in relation. I mean, life is a response part of this thing, and that's its own nature. But the poem happening is not a response. The poem happening is an event. And of course, we engaged in this event, our response, because that's what we are as this, everything, this kind of pulsating life, will be there. In other words, the tide consists of many different things, but and we don't know, certainly, I must say that my concept of the tide is an image that stands for something I know, I'm sure is real. I'm sure there's evidence when you take these groups that something happens in language and poetry, and how do we know it? But we're forming ourselves within this. That's what I meant, not the tide.
Alan and I yesterday were trying to think of this exactly the same thing. Remember we were saying, when is the tide coming? Is it every 35 years?
Yes.
Then we began to realize that we couldn't.
Yeah, no.
We didn't know.
Warren, if you take it back to anatomies, so we're out of the business of poetry and personalities, you could tell by looking at the life on a sea rock, you could tell what the tide had been. But the life on the sea rock isn't shaping the tide, it's shaped by it, so you can tell. And there's a way of looking at these people to tell what the tide was. And yet every one of those is shaping a life within that, and we can tell because the life is a cooperation with this tide, what that's been like. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, but they've had new phases. This is what's interesting. Yes, it's quite relevant. If we take what this period is, this is the period of the cantos that are called the Adams cantos, or the American cantos, and the Chinese cantos. So for Pound, it's a period that goes up to, oh, by the way, this is the First World War. Talk about this tide is not just poetry. This is the First World War, and it's very clear that in our time, only the war is real. We have never been out of it. As Paul Maddox, chilling our bones, now here comes the Second World War, right along here. Second World War. Now, this group became concerned, and they're a shadow of another shadow, because if we looked at paroxysms, this war between nations goes down like this, and before in the 19th century, there would then have been an eternal war in which, in the 19th century, a proletariat and a middle class, the property war, the internal war within the nation, the external war of extra-national, and then it curves up again to this. Now, this is the proper area, and Rex Rolfe, Patchen, Lukeyser, or there are other, and then the parts of the same picture, because it's the very same picture, are a little previous but of that, are Tate, Hart Crane, John Crow Ransom. They are a reactionary generation to something that happens here. They reacted to the war. These people are just absolutely against the war. I mean, insanely, Pound ends up, by the time another war appears, so cracked. But listen, all you have to do is go back and see what that First World War was. These people saw their contemporaries, other poets, kill. They didn't have 4 F's in those days. No, if they were, people today who found the great solution of really not qualifying for the Second World War, in this period they didn't know that little secret. These people, however, did not qualify for that war.
None of them, none of these people qualified for that war. So we're pitching the tide. It's as simple as that. And there were other poets who did qualify for the war, like Rupert Brooke, and when the Second World War came, Osbert Sitwell came to the king and said, you can't draft poets. England won't have any poets at all if you do it. So they're only left undraftable Dylan Thomas and undraftable Dame Edith Sitwell surviving. Now, undraftable Kenneth Rexroth and undraftable Patchen and undraftable Miro Rukeyser still felt very quaky during this period, but they belong to a period between wars, and this has unreality. We're not in a period between wars. This Second World War never disappeared. You try to trace it through. Now, Maddox said there would be, he thought there would be 150 years of war, in the first place, he saw that, like the wars of religion, that this would be a great superb war with politics, and which we think is awfully important, but before that people thought religion was awfully important, and politics might, like religion, be our own business. And so after fighting, reacting, finally everybody gets so tired of it, they say, oh, it's our own business. And then they think, find something else. But that's another picture of these Trotskyisms. Now what I want to say about these people is that Williams was Patterson. This is oblivion for them, too. H.G. during this period, Red Roses for Bronze appeared in 1936. I've never found anybody who even knew about it. I mean, that it existed, and it's quite like Williams's, or comparable to Pound's cantos of that period. These, Patterson, the Pisan cantos, and the very first one of them to appear, because H.G. was in the bombing of London, and it appeared in 1942, is the War Trilogy, which then appears for the next 3 years. This begins to appear in 1946, I think it is, or 7. This is the thing that made the big change for all of us, was the appearance of Patterson. Because you then recognize, so what I mean is this life, living that long, so that we get another picture of the tide. Here are people who think, God, they had it so, they were big, all capable, and then filled with the tide. So all of a sudden, everything fills the poem. That's what you call this period. Everything feeds the poem. We can grow. They can have an entire new life. So Pound hadn't written anything like the Pisan cantos. The shape of Pound was absolutely knotted like that in no tide at all. You try to read through those middle cantos, and suddenly breaking out with madness. He isn't shattered in this period. It can even be said he's a bore. He learned, yes, you have to be a bore. You bore and hold on and wait until... But that's exactly when you're writing a poem.
What do you do when there's no poem there and you've got the want? Well, you may really sit with that want and you may really write things that you keep thinking, is that all my poor want can reach this? If you've got it at all, what a poem. And maybe only in these periods do you get it. Like certainly... Being young and in this period starting, you get shaken by this feeling of a flood of possibilities that lies in this area. And so more and more people want to be in it. More and more people can be mistaken about it, but you're not mistaken. I mean, that's like telling somebody they're mistaken for you. Because they're just a bumper crop, so you can start growing it. That was yesterday.
Anyway,
that's an hour and back to me.
Your presence in the poem is just sort of very
high. I think Robert began one time after Paul Max Finstein. Robert said people be very loose about the poets, what poets are in our message. Well, I'm not a poet, you're not a poet, one's only a poet when you're writing a poem, so that you have a very imperfect memory of what the actual state of feeling is. Because first of all, if you're not really interested in the state of feeling, it's an activity. It is an activity, so that it takes care of its own definition in that sense. But I was being hopeful. Okay, hopeful. 2 days ago this was. The shatter of the sense of possibility at that moment. In other words, in the beginning, think of it from my point of view, not that you can't think of it, but we were starting a context which I distrust, you see, with every, with all my nature. At the same time, I'm so pleased that they're here, so I'm delighted. But I have this painful contradiction in my recognition of where we are in the circumstance. And then I was thinking of the poem. I was trying to rid my presence of any particular weight. I suppose, in another reference, for example, I remember saying that I wanted to literally lose myself completely. I said that I wanted the song to pass into that anonymity, which is all song. I wanted to lose the face of the person, which is always intrusive, unless it can be free to be material, as all things are in fact possibilities in any activity. That eternal event. I suppose I wanted not to miss the eternal event because I thought I had something else to do in that way. But see, I wanted to represent complete confusion, apropos definition of disorder. I guess I committed. Whereas
with Mr. Duncan on the page, we seem closer. You seem more divorced. That is,
no, it doesn't at all, because when Freely said he's not interested in that event, when it's not there, when he's not engaged in it, I often am interested in what that event is when I'm not engaged in it. I mean, that's good. My curiosity will go there outside. But I have always had an idea of a poet as being a thing, and that's not me. But as I said, giving another picture, that may be in part because it's the only way in which I'm at ease with some of the things that actually happen and get expressed in the poem, as coming out of, you know, as my being involved in.
I'm still trying to understand myself. I think first I was speaking myself metaphorically as the eye, the eye of the intention. In other words, the eye as the sense of the person, as I being volitional, ego, intentional, programmatic, conscious of its history, self-conscious of its history. All of these issues, when I am writing, do shrink to an extraordinarily small, you know, element, and equally they become just vague, the I, all the history terms of I, where I was yesterday, where I am now, where I'll be tomorrow, all this making up of myself becomes very small, and then other things, I hear other things. I mean, something is certain. That Indian expression, something big is happening to me, is happening. And Robert's sense of the universe. The universe can be it's like how many angels can dance on each other's hand. Or what is the sound of one hand clapping? You move in that realm where meaning is order.
I mean, I don't understand what the whole question was.
Oh, it wasn't.
Disorder.
Well, I was beginning to wonder if because I was going to ask you again back. Do you have any sense of being a different occasion than the person writing the poem?
No,
take it. I mean, just
no.
You have a sense that there's some that there's some
different vocabulary than you.
But
do, so
but
I'm
I went no. All I'm asking is there an I that belongs entirely to the poem Howl and is not yours? And it's not, and doesn't belong to the poem Kaddish.
Well, it doesn't belong to the poem Howl or to me.
Hmm.
It's bigger than both of us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, then.
No, that is to say, I identify in language, presumably, the experience, as it occurs to me, of what you speak of as roots,
yeah,
with the word eternity.
Well, okay.
Or at other times, recently, this last
the whole damn piece in eternity.
Yeah. But, but that's just my use of the word.
Yeah.
That's all, because that's the way the word is given to me. Like, I didn't decide to use it. It's just that's what it meant when it happened. Or that's what the word that was around in a couple of books when it...
Oh, but I guess there is a difference, because I tend to identify those roots with time. Since I portrayed it as an evolution. But I meant I do tend to portray it as time, because I related it to an evolution, whereas it can also be thought of as right here, right here roots.
McClure, the thing that McClure does
in Revolt is to skip the time evolution thing, and really, McClure, at least as I get it in Revolt, McClure says, I had my roots, or I grew out of any, and in the first place, you know that you didn't grow out of contemporary planaria. He draws a very different picture from this tree, which I tend to draw. He draws a wave, and in which everything living is at the crest of the wave. And the crest of the wave is, this is bigger than you or
recently, the vocabulary and the thinking process, that area, the meaning thing that uses the word eternity, or how, rather, changing slightly, so I begin to say self, and then I begin locating it over here, because that's the way it's, or that's the closest I can get to indicating the direction. In fact, I don't even know about the Rubin anymore. The only thing I'm feeling right now is this. So what do I want to worry about?
I've always been intrigued by poets like Shakespeare who had no self. If you take the place, you can't find it. That's why people are always sure somebody else wrote it. I mean, actually, somebody else wrote it all the way through. I mean, is he Lady Macbeth? Is he Macbeth? Is he who? I mean, the ones who speak in many selves and voices. So that your question about this business of identity is one of the things, I think the thing to say at this point simply is, one of the very first things adventures you're launching out on when you write, now let's not worry about poem, because let's not make this division, when you write is that you're launching out into a thing that we can call self, certainly, if we make it as big as Alan does, or as McClure does with his crest, you are inventing. You are making a new statement of what that self can be.
You're manifesting.
Manifesting it. Yes, and as a matter of fact, that's why you're a channel, because then you become the.
But you are.
Occasion, you're the occasion when it can manifest. But the funny thing is, you've got to find the way for this thing to be manifested. And so the writer of Howl is, in a sense, the writer of the Pindar poem. In the sense that we recognize there's a writer, there's something being said of terrific importance in these
lives. Why were we arguing in those years, then?
In which years?
When you were writing Pindar and I was writing Howl, we were arguing with each other.
Oh, but by God, we weren't doing anything like... Now, let's see. Pound wrote to William Carlos Williams that H.D. was a...
I thought you were somewhat different from me.
I am! I've got a tie on. I know I've got these kids on, but I'll put on shoes tomorrow.
That part is not interesting.
See, I understand now why you groan when somebody says differentiated or undifferentiated.
We were thinking
I like the differentiations. That's what I think is one of the differences.
We asked this following poem. We asked, where are you? Point to yourself. And do you point to here, or where do you point? Where are you? We were talking in terms of the confusion that perhaps people felt as to relating to our use of consciousness.
Yeah.
We were saying it's something that
Robert
really
cool.
Beautiful, yeah, that's
awesome. There is one thing in child psychology,
there's
still
puzzling. How refers to her head, it wasn't really sure, and then she did this beautiful thing of putting her hands on it
like that too.
And it was a manifest.
What got me is that they still haven't figured out how a child figures out that anything above here is him. I mean, how a baby's discovery that this thing up here, or back here, is somehow me, is evidently such a jump. that still is it. The psychologists say, well, how do they do that? hey, you.
In India, they have different me's. So usually they say, in answer to the question, who am I, there was a big saint called Ramana Maharshi. He said, if you ask anybody to point to themselves, always point over here. Me, which he said was on the right side, not the heart side.
I see, right side.
Then the Japanese Buddhists, one are located here. And Tibetans want sometimes to locate it here. But then Ramakrishna said it begins in the asshole with the Muladhara chakra. The first opening of the self is there.
Your mother said, don't point.
Any attempt to understand your opposed feel in this way becomes the same danger,
mm-hmm.
no matter where it occurs, by the way.
And yet we're doing, that's just exactly where all in the poem is an attempt to understand.
I'm ashamed of the possibilities of this poem, but I'm not ashamed of it.
Well, no, actually, there is some use in pointing up to a limited extent. In other words, if someone is insistent, it is here, and then you say, well, why not there? And they say, well, maybe. So then they can start shifting around and finally say, well, it's nowhere, it's everywhere.
Well, we've had centuries that have had the mythology of our thinking with our brain, but you can go through the simple business of thinking with any other part of your body, and it really isn't part of our science that we know what we think with. It's in the same way that they say I'm here, that we say I'm in there, in that little organ, and actually that little organ is not really there. Well, maybe. Now, if any of you took that down and sell it, it's a nasty pretty well. I mean, but we do tend to think the eye's here or in the heart, which is, we say, I feel here, or even that the senses are at our fingertips as part of a map picture we have. And the poet at the level of making these maps can, at certain periods, reimagine. Certainly, all of these came from great poetic events. Really great poetic event. It was a great poetic event when we became here. And it will be another one when any time we can exist in some... I mean, these new pictures, these are much bigger. Talk about a big poetic event. We still all belong to the one as we... the world is coming together, so we now know all these poetic events. We now know... one of the things that I notice in critics criticizing most of the new poetry, they criticize it really because of the religion. Allen Ginsberg has got Buddhism in his poetry. And during the First World War, I registered in a CO, and they said, well, what religion do you belong to? I said, well, I feel closest to Taoism, and they said, that's not American. And then they said it wasn't religion, and I said, a fourth of the world's population follows it. They said, well, they're not Americans. That was the statement at that point. But the thing is, actually, that at periods of history, real great waves have happened, and I think that's part of this wave, because wherever the Indian world has as it did in the second century, between the second century BC, between Alexander, in the Alexandrian period, the third century BC, and the third or fourth century AD, the Hindu world and the Mediterranean world were in constant exchange. There were some of the terms that they have in yogi now actually come from Neoplatonists, and they had schools of Buddhism in Alexandria as early as the earliest Gnostic texts had theories, for instance, that if Buddha was Horus, the god Horus, then Maya was the Isis, then Isis was the other Maya, or the veil of illusion. And that's where we have our veil of Isis, which comes from the Isis. Originally was no veiled figure. The veil of Isis comes from the veil of Maya. And this exchange really produced one of the great, great, great poetic things, images. And we're still in them. But the reflux, talk about how these tides come in. The reflux, especially in insane Pacific Coast, and California is especially famous for having weird cults of one kind or another. The opening of doors, now we don't have to talk about openings of doors this way, openings of doors between massive people, so that we suddenly find out, yes, we, like he says, well, how come if we're one, but we're saying that all over the world. How come we were two different peoples when we find out we're also one people, and I have to find out that I am where you are in order for you, and also so that you take place, you turn to other peoples, the thing that for instance, Lawrence turned. It interested me that when all these people went to Europe, Lawrence came to America. Yeah, I mean, he came to American Indians, and they were going back to Greek primitive. But that is a very important that the Englishmen came here to find the source, and that they went there to find the source. They weren't mistaken. They were going in the same kind. The geographical movement tells you the story. And between these, the Indian and the primitive Greek became one for us and came down, but then have to be revived. And now I'm talking about the Indian of the Southwest and the Maya, especially. But now, one of the things that Olson, I didn't even talk about what happens as the wave as it really hits, and with its very first figure, with projected verse, and the very first papers, which are the Mayan letters, you've got a search that can be identified back to this. It could be said to come out of this. But at the same time, Olson was in Guatemala and was, there are real movements of people to places, to, and for instance, I don't find, now the very important is the role of some, a person with great discretion is Gary Snyder. I mean, his poetry has great discretion. But in Alan's poetry, where you actually get the mixture, where there is not this discretion, because you can't say Alan is a Buddhist, it won't work. But Gary really is one, just as Gary's lines are discrete, and if you follow through myths and texts and the whole of Gary's work, what you have that is not like Gary's model comes from Jefferson Pound and also Rex Rolfe, but what you find is as if all this thing is very shaky in Rex Rolfe is absolutely solid in Gary's poetry. For one thing, its discretion is strong. The discretions here are absolutely shot and weak. They're so, I mean, you just go through the poetry, it has no way of holding what actually Gary finds what is the instincts, I think, have very much in common to make a well-made poetry and to have a very important to Rex Roth was a ritual, and he also talked about sacramental center, but he needed limitation. He wanted to have a limited thing that everything wouldn't intrude upon. Yet it was impossible, then it just got shattered in it. And in Gary, this whole thing could open up and be an open flower. But it's not his going to Japan is part of the movement, but for instance, his poetry is not muddle. The muddle is invaluable. This is another thing, by the way, that Allen Ginsberg and I would share is the muddle, because certainly the muddle of many, many, many different sources is my main thing that excites me to a poem. I do have to, in order to even find my way, become flooded with things that culturally wouldn't make sense in the except they make sense to throw away the culture and find out that they're all part of some human thing and not write just from one center. I think that's what I'm actually Gary's person writes from one center and grows that way. You have the strength of this thing in a poem. So you don't expect violence. There are breaks up, changes in the poem.
Yeah, now he's breaking up and getting cuts.
Yeah.
Real nice and silly.
Oh, you mean in the Hellenistic period? No, I didn't say Mayan. The Maya is the mother of Buddha and the Maya of the Hindu Indian. Between India, you see, when Alexander, that's another, now war has something to do with it. Alexander's war and push through to India opened it up and changed all of Greece, all the Greek world, and changed the Hindu world, as a matter of fact, so that you have counterparts for both. You have a whole great, you have in the realm of sculptural poetry and the image, the whole image changes and then is reabsorbed in India, but very, very Greek for quite a period. And as I said, I was amazed. Gradually, I've learned some of these. Now, why it's difficult to come across some of this is that most people who enter in certain fields, say a Greek scholar, a person who wants to learn Greek, usually has, in wanting to learn Greek, a picture of classical Greek, so he has a distaste already for the very period I'm talking about. And so it's only in a long, through people who want, if you want to learn Coptic, you have to be in that period, so people who wanted to learn Coptic have to translate texts and boobs like me then can read them. That tell us this story. But Greek scholars have, you know, the Loeb Library goes on forever, but does not have crucial texts that they view as rather unsavory. I mean, it's like, you know, Howell would remain untranslated forever if they had to get into classical Greek, because the people who learn classical Greek don't like to think things ever were like that. Well, so we get an awful picture. Actually, you can find references. And there was an unsavory poem in the 4th century, about the same time as Plato, by Ginsbonopolis called, I think it was called, well, we translate it squeak because we feel, but it showed barbaric influences, and that's paragraph two, and you went, where's the text, you say? Except some monk in monkeys were handing it around in the 8th century, and then suddenly they had a period in which they decided to do away with bad writing, and so we don't have it any longer.
It never took place. It never took place. Neither will we.
I want to get actually back to this, what's happening in the book, this event occurring. And I'd like to get the whole, big tide.
We can't forget that.
Well,
we
can't forget.
But you can't forget. We were talking, just as these people, as Robert's saying, as Pound and Eliot went to England and to Europe looking, and Lawrence came to America and also went to Yucatan at a later time, but at the same time, in this context, we were shifts of consciousness were Alan's and myself's way of saying where is it? Since we were this was a characterization of the experience of recognizing sources, and we were thinking we could move ourselves to the source. I was impatient there, I waited for the walk.
Mm-hmm.
Which, to the instant, that withdrawn. I mean, in the personal sense, the water that wasn't there at that moment.
We weren't manifesting very much at that moment.
And we thought we could move ourselves to the water.
Yeah.
But it turns out the mountain does come. It's
going to do. What did you want to say about it?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I wasn't thinking of a pearl. I remember I did have a face.
Don't make anything pretty, just say
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Is it a question of writing?
You mean you're instructing oysters now? We got a new movement among oysters? All out? No pearls?
You can make it. I can't.
It depends on what the person will be.
Well, now look, I do think all of our hackles can rise on this business about divorce, about saying mustn't there be this care and discipline. You start in the beginning, and you're supposed to start with care and discipline. You don't know one damn thing, and you cannot impose any care or any discipline except where you have learned something, and you don't learn anything until you write. You gradually learn in writing a certain cares that you can take. You gradually learn, but you don't learn many, and you learn more habits than you learn cares. And you gradually, and what most people want is give me a discipline and I'll conform. And that is just, Yeah. Well, I think I indicated that my own experience is very, very different from that. I'm one of the world's worst critics of my own work. I've interfered with it at times and then found, oh, how horrible. And
this has nothing to do with what they think they were.
Oh, but listen, let's, I think, get back to part of it, because I grabbed that you talked about the care, because I do, and then wanted to give my hostility toward the business of wanting to start out with this. So what, since I, after all, had this business of obedience, what is it we obey, or what is it we take care of? Now, one thing I think that illuminates a lot about the business of writing. When you sit down to write a poem, you cannot write the poem any better than you were actually at the point when this want goes forward to the poem. You can't write any better than you know how to. But in between, you can learn lots of things by writing. As a matter of fact, Cocteau has he's the source of the statement. Radiguet had said, Cocteau said, how do you write? Here's Radiguet, 17-year-old or something, and he wrote two absolutely beautiful, perfect little novels, and you know, Cocteau says, like, how do you do it? And he said, Radiguet says, but you can't write any better than you do write. And so one of the disorders is trying to write better than you do write. But then how do you learn it? What do you learn? One of the first things you learn in the poem is you learn by your own love of previous poetry, and you also learn, I learned, by exercises of all kinds, of exercising the rhyme. Now usually, for instance, the academic or the conventional poem asks you to rhyme when you do not know how to. It is one of the things that should be left at the most, should operate from, Hookman says it should grow like melons on a vine. It should be rhythmically related here in the flow and come in the flow. But at the same time, all of this area has to operate in the rhyme, and you have to learn all the many choices you have in the rhyme. And so rightly poets are attracted to rhyming games and to knowing these vowels, knowing more and more. See, the more this mind can know about those vowels, the freer it'll be to practically go to sleep then when you're writing the poem.